Chapter 2. I say hang the bastard. Oscar, mind your language in front of the girls. They've heard worse. It's insane. The scum murders 4 kids and some cretin of a judge throws the case out of court because the defendant was too stoned on drugs to understand his rights. God, can you believe it? Carolyn Lucas poured her husband's first cup of coffee for the day and whisked their 2 young daughters off to the school bus stop. He gestured menacingly at the TV as if it were the fault of the anchorman announcing the news that the killer roamed free. Oscar Lucas had a way of talking with his hands that bore little resemblance to sign language for the deaf. He sat stoop-shouldered at the breakfast table, a position that camouflaged his lanky 6-foot frame. His head was as bald as an egg except for a few graying strands around the temples, and his bushy brows hovered over a pair of oak-brown eyes. Not one to join the Washington, D.C. Blue Pinstripe Brigade, he was dressed in slacks and sport coat. In his early 40s, Lucas might have passed for a dentist or bookkeeper instead of the special agent in charge of the Presidential Protection Division of the Secret Service. During his 20 years as an agent, he had fooled many people with his nice neighbor-next-door appearance, from the presidents whose lives he guarded to the potential assassins he'd stonewalled before they had an opportunity to act. On the job, he came off aggressive and solemn. Yet at home, he was usually full of mischief and humor. Except, of course, when he was influenced by the 8 a.m. news. Lucas took a final sip of coffee and rose from the table. He held open his coat, he was left-handed, and adjusted the high-ride hip holster holding a Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum Model 19 revolver with a 2.5-inch barrel. The standard-issue gun was provided by the service when he had finished training and started out as a rookie agent in the Denver field office investigating counterfeiters and forgers. He had drawn it only twice in the line of duty, but had yet to pull the trigger outside a firing range. Carolyn was unloading the dishwasher when he came up behind her, pulled away a cascade of blonde hair, and pecked her on the neck. "I'm off. Don't forget tonight is the pool party across the street at the Hardings'. I should be home in time. The boss isn't scheduled to leave the White House today." She looked up at him and smiled. "You see that he doesn't." "I'll inform the president first thing that my wife frowns on me working late." She laughed and leaned her head briefly on his shoulder. 6 o'clock. "You win," he said in mock weariness, and stepped out the back door. Lucas backed his leased government car, a plush Buick sedan, into the street and headed downtown. Before reaching the end of the block, he called the Secret Service Central Command Office over his car radio. "Crown, this is Lucas. I'm en route to the White House." "Have a nice trip," a metallic voice replied. Already he began to sweat. He turned on the air conditioner. The summer heat in the nation's capital never seemed to slacken. The humidity was in the 90s, and the flags along Embassy Row on Massachusetts Avenue hung limp and lifeless in the muggy air. He slowed and stopped at the checkpoint gate on West Executive Avenue and paused for a few moments while a uniformed guard of the service nodded and passed him through. Lucas parked the car and entered the West Executive entrance on the lower level of the White House. At the SS command post, codenamed W-16, he stopped to chat with the men monitoring an array of electronic communication equipment. Then he took the stairs to his office on the second floor of the East Wing. The first thing he did each morning after settling behind his desk was to check the president's schedule, along with advance reports by the agents in charge of planning security. Lucas studied the folder containing future presidential movements a second time, consternation growing across his face. There had been an unexpected addition, a big one. He flung down the folder in irritation, swung around in his swivel chair, and stared at the wall. Most presidents were creatures of habit, ran tight schedules, and rigidly adhered to them. Clocks could be set by Nixon's comings and goings. Reagan and Carter seldom deviated from fixed plans. Not the new man in the Oval Office. He looked upon the Secret Service detail as a nuisance, and what was worse, he was unpredictable as hell. To Lucas and his deputy agents, it was a 24-hour game trying to keep one step ahead of the man, guessing where he might suddenly decide to go and when, and what visitors he might invite without providing time for proper security measures. It was a game Lucas often lost. In less than a minute, he was down the stairs and in the West Wing, confronting the second most powerful man in the executive branch, Chief of Staff Daniel Fawcett. "Good morning, Oscar," Fawcett said, smiling benignly. "I thought you'd come charging in about now." "There appears to be a new excursion in the schedule," Lucas said, his tone businesslike. "Sorry about that, but a big vote is coming up on aid to the Eastern Bloc countries, and the President wants to work his charms on Senator Larimer and Speaker of the House Moran to swing their support for his program." "So he's taking them for a boat ride?" "Why not? Every president since Herbert Hoover has used the presidential yacht for high-level conferences." "I'm not arguing the reason," Lucas replied firmly. "I'm protesting the timing." Fawcett gave him an innocent look. "What's wrong with Friday evening?" "You know damn well what's wrong. That's only 2 days away." "So?" "For a cruise down the Potomac with an overnight layover at Mount Vernon, my advance team needs 5 days to plan security. A complete system of communications and alarms has to be installed on the grounds. The boat must be swept for explosives and listening devices, the shores checked out, and the Coast Guard requires lead time to provide a cutter on the river as an escort. We can't do a decent job in 2 days." Fawcett was a feisty, eager individual with a sharp nose, a square red face, and intense eyes. He always looked like a demolition expert eyeing a deserted building.
"Don't you think you're making this into an overkill, Oscar? Assassinations take place on crowded streets or in theaters. Whoever heard of a head of state being attacked on a boat?" "It can happen anywhere, anytime," Lucas said with an uncompromising look. "Have you forgotten the guy we stopped who was attempting to hijack a plane he intended to crash into Air Force One? The fact is, most assassination attempts take place when the President is away from his customary haunts." "The President is firm on the date," Fawcett said. "As long as you work for the President, you'll do as you're ordered, same as me. If he wants to row a dinghy alone to Miami, that's his choice." Fawcett had struck the wrong nerve. Lucas' face turned rigid, and he moved until he was standing toe-to-toe with the White House Chief of Staff. "First off, by order of Congress, I don't work for the President. I work for the Treasury Department. So he can't tell me to bug off and go his own way. My duty is to provide him with the best security with the least inconvenience to his private life. When he takes the elevator to his living quarters upstairs, my men and I remain below. But from the time he steps out on the first floor until he goes back up again, his ass belongs to the Secret Service." Fawcett was perceptive about the personalities of the men who worked around the President. He realized he'd overstepped with Lucas and was wise enough to call off the war. He knew Lucas was dedicated to his job and loyal beyond any question to the man in the Oval Office. But there was no way they could be close friends. Professional associates, perhaps, reserved, but watchful of each other. Since they were not rivals for power, they would never be enemies. "No need to get upset, Oscar. I stand reprimanded. I'll inform the President of your concern. But I doubt if he'll change his mind." Lucas sighed. "We'll do our best with the time left, but he must be made to understand that it's imperative for him to cooperate with his security people." "What can I say? You know better than I do that all politicians think they're immortal. To them, power is more than an aphrodisiac. It's a drug high and alcoholic haze combined. Nothing excites them or inflates their ego like a mob of people cheering and clamoring to shake their hand. That's why they're all vulnerable to a killer standing in the right place at the right time." "Tell me about it," said Lucas. "I've babysat 4 presidents." "And you haven't lost a one," Fawcett added. "I came close twice with Ford, once with Reagan." "You can't predict behavior patterns accurately." "Maybe not, but after all these years in the protection racket, you develop a gut reaction. That's why I feel uneasy about this boat cruise." Fawcett stiffened. "You think someone is out to kill him?" "Someone is always out to kill him. We investigate 20 possible crazies a day and carry an active caseload of 2,000 persons we consider dangerous or capable of assassination." Fawcett put his hand on Lucas' shoulder. "Don't worry, Oscar. Friday's excursion won't be given to the press until the last minute. I promise you that much." "I appreciate that, Dan. Besides, what can happen out on the Potomac?" "Maybe nothing. Maybe the unexpected," Lucas answered, a strange vacancy in his voice. "It's the unexpected that gives me nightmares." Megan Blair, the President's secretary, noticed Dan Fawcett standing in the doorway of her cubbyhole office and nodded at him over her typewriter.
"Hi, Dan. I didn't see you."
"How's the chief this morning?" he asked, his daily ritual of testing the water before entering the Oval Office.
"Tired. she answered. The reception honoring the movie industry ran past 1 a.m. Megan was a handsome woman in her early 40s with a bright, small-town friendliness. She wore her black hair cropped short and was 10 pounds on the skinny side. She was a dynamo who loved her job and her boss like nothing else in her life. She arrived early, left late, and worked weekends. Unmarried, with only 2 casual affairs behind her, she relished her independent, single life. Fawcett was always amazed that she could carry on a conversation and type at the same time.
"I'll tread lightly and keep his appointments to a minimum so he can take it easy."
"You're too late. He's already in conference with Admiral Sandecker."
"Who?"
"Admiral James Sandecker, director of the National Underwater and Marine Agency."
A look of annoyance crossed Fawcett's face. He took his role as the guardian of the president's time seriously and resented any intrusion on his territory. Any penetration of his protective ring was a threat to his power base. How in hell had Sandecker sneaked around him, he wondered. Megan read his mood.
"The president sent for the admiral," she explained. "I think he's expecting you to sit in on the meeting."
Pacified to a small degree, Fawcett nodded and walked into the Oval Office. The president was seated on a sofa studying several papers strewn on a large coffee table. A short, thin man with red hair and a matching Van Dyke beard sat across from him. The president looked up. "Dan, I'm glad you're here. You know Admiral Sandecker?"
"Yes."
Sandecker rose and shook his hand. The admiral's grip was firm and brief. He nodded wordlessly to Fawcett, curtly acknowledging his presence. It was not rudeness on Sandecker's part. He came across as a man who played straight ball, encasing himself in a cold, tensile shell, bowing to no one. He was hated and envied in Washington, but universally respected because he never chose sides and always delivered what was asked of him. The president motioned Fawcett to the sofa, patting a cushion next to him. "Sit down, Dan. I've asked the admiral to brief me on a crisis that's developed in the waters off Alaska."
"I haven't heard of it."
"I'm not surprised," said the president. "The report only came to my attention an hour ago." He paused and pointed the tip of a pencil at an area circled in red on a large nautical chart. "Here, 180 miles southwest of Anchorage in the Cook Inlet region, an undetermined poison is killing everything in the sea."
"Sounds like you're talking oil spill?"
"Far worse," replied Sandecker, leaning back on the couch. "What we have here is an unknown agent that causes death in humans and sea life less than 1 minute after contact."
"How is that possible?"
"Most poisonous compounds gain access to the body by ingestion or inhalation," Sandecker explained. "The stuff we're dealing with kills by skin absorption."
"It must be highly concentrated in a small area to be so potent."
"If you call 1,000 square miles of open water small..." The president looked puzzled.
"I can't imagine a substance with such awesome potency."
Fawcett looked at the admiral.
"What kind of statistics are we facing?"
"A Coast Guard cutter found a Kodiak fishing boat drifting with the crew dead. 2 investigators and a doctor were sent aboard and died too. A team of geophysicists on an island 30 miles away were found dead by a bush pilot flying in supplies. He died while sending out a distress signal. A few hours later, a Japanese fishing trawler reported seeing a school of nearly 100 gray whales suddenly turn belly up. The trawler then disappeared. No trace was found. Crab beds, seal colonies wiped out. That's only the beginning. There may be many more fatalities that we don't have word on yet.
If the spread continues unchecked, what's the worst we can expect?"
"The virtual extinction of all marine life in the Gulf of Alaska. And if it enters the Japan Current and is carried south, it could poison every man, fish, animal, and bird it touched along the west coast as far south as Mexico. The human death toll could conceivably reach into the hundreds of thousands. Fishermen, swimmers, anyone who walked along a contaminated shoreline, anybody who ate contaminated fish. It's like a chain reaction. I don't even want to think what might happen if it evaporates into the atmosphere and falls with the rain over the inland states."
Fawcett found it almost impossible to grasp the enormity of it.
"Christ, what in hell is it?"
"Too early to tell," Sandecker replied. "The Environmental Protection Agency has a computerized mass data storage and retrieval system that contains detailed information on 200 relevant characteristics of some 1,100 chemical compounds. Within a few seconds, they can determine the effects a hazardous substance can have when spilled, its trade name, formula, major producers, mode of transportation, and threat to the environment. The Alaskan contamination doesn't fit any of the data in their computer files. Surely they must have some idea. No, sir, they don't. There is one slim possibility, but without autopsy reports, it's strictly conjecture.
I'd like to hear it, the president said.
Sandecker took a deep breath. The three worst poisonous substances known to man are plutonium, dioxin, and a chemical warfare system. The first two don't fit the pattern. The third, at least in my mind, is a prime suspect. The president stared at Sandecker, realization and shock on his face.
Nerve Agent S, he said slowly.
Sandecker nodded silently.
That's why the EPA wouldn't have a handle on it, the president mused. The formula is ultra-secret.
Fawcett turned to the president.
I'm afraid I'm not familiar.
Nerve Agent S was an ungodly compound the scientists at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal developed about 20 years ago, the president explained. I've read the report on the tests. It could kill within a few seconds of touching the skin. It seemed the ideal answer to an enemy wearing gas masks or protective gear. It clung to everything it touched. But its properties were too unstable, as dangerous to the troops dispersing it as to those on the receiving end. The Army gave up on it and buried it in the Nevada desert.
I fail to see a connection between Nevada and Alaska, Fawcett said.
During shipment by railroad from the arsenal outside Denver, Sandecker enlightened him, a boxcar containing nearly 1,000 gallons of Nerve Agent S vanished. It is still missing and unaccounted for. If the spill is indeed this nerve agent, once it's found, what is the process for eliminating it?
Sandecker shrugged.
Unfortunately, the present state of the art in containment and cleanup technology and the physical-chemical characteristics of Nerve Agent S are such that once it enters the water, very little can be done to ameliorate the penetration. Our only hope is to cut off the source before it releases enough poison to turn the ocean into a cesspool devoid of all life.
Any lead on where it originates? Asked the president.
In all probability, a ship sunk between Kodiak Island and the Alaskan mainland, replied Sandecker. Our next step is to backtrace the currents and draw up a search grid. The president leaned over the coffee table and studied the red circle on the chart for a few moments. Then he gave Sandecker an appraising stare.
As director of NUMA, Admiral, you'll have the dirty job of neutralizing this thing. You have my authority to tap any agency or department of the government with the necessary expertise. The National Science Board, the Army and Coast Guard, the EPA, whoever. He paused thoughtfully, then asked,
Exactly how potent is Nerve Agent S in seawater?
Sandecker looked tired, his face drawn.
1 teaspoon will kill every living organism in 4 million gallons of seawater.
Then we better find it, said the president, a touch of desperation in his voice, and damned quick.